practice of music that it has very deep connections with another practice like dance, you know, could be something else, but in that case it's dance, is that it really reframes the way we think of what our priorities are. For me, growing up, so I was studying, you know, classical music, but I was also accompanying my dad's step dancing classes and sometimes social, you know, dancing. Something I quickly realized was that the utmost priority of my playing needed to be like, will it drive and inspire the dancers? Are they going to have fun?
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. There's such a fascinating variety to a life in music, and this series features wonderful musicians worldwide with in-depth conversations and great music, with over 100 episodes to explore. For this week's episode, I was able to add some additional music to a special re-release with fiddler Alexis Chartrand, who has shared three tracks for you to listen to. His Bandcamp and socials are linked in the show notes, so please go buy the tracks or albums if you like what you hear. Alexis talks very thoughtfully about his background as a son of dancers, about both groove and ornamentation in different traditional styles of fiddling, his explorations of tone color with Baroque violin, and some of his musical influences and inspiration. Like all my episodes, this is available wherever you listen to podcasts. The video of the original episode is on my YouTube, and the transcript is also linked to my website, leahroseman.com, where you can sign up for my weekly podcast newsletter and get access to sneak peeks for upcoming guests. Please do share this episode and consider following me on your preferred social media and supporting this podcast. Everything is linked to my website, and the support link is also directly linked in the show notes.
Hey, welcome. Alexis Chartrand, amazing fiddler and innovator. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So you're in Montreal, and I know you're going to play some music for us today. Do you want to start with a tune?
Oh, yeah, I could. Yeah, could play a little Quebecois jig. Why not? From the repertoire of Joseph Allard. So Joseph Allard was a fiddler who was born in the end of the 19th century, and he lived until the mid 20th century. And he was known as the Prince of Fiddlers, and he also was the teacher of the first teacher of Jean Carignan. So his musical legacy has been quite important. So here, a little jig.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
that was
you.
Just gorgeous. I was just thinking about the fact that, of course, you're playing with a mic and you perform with a mic.
But often, yeah.
Yeah. So back in the day, of course, people were playing in kitchens, but they would have, you know, big dances for the community, and they'd have to kind of crank it out. So that it must have changed people's playing to be able to do more subtle things as they had amplification, do you think?
I think the question of amplification does have a fair bit of impact on the playing. My playing is not always amplified, and I really I like to be able to do both, and it's something that I really try to make a part of my practice, not to leave, you know, either out of it. And so I do adapt my playing for, you know, whether I'm playing acoustically or in a bigger hall or in a smaller hall, mm-hmm. or whether I'm playing with a microphone and a PA in a bigger space or in a smaller space. And I think, you know, both setups are interesting for different reasons. And I like to be sensitive and mindful of that fact. Regarding playing the playing of older Quebecois fiddlers, they didn't necessarily have access to amplification, especially in the earlier part of the 20th century. But it became something quite normal, you know, pretty, you know, early during the revival, as some of these fiddlers, you know, were starting to be showcased in events, mm-hmm. you know, in festivals, in different settings. And I mean, if we're talking about dance music, then often the communities that gathered to dance, it wasn't hundreds of people, mm-hmm. you know. And so it was possible for, you know, a fiddler or a small ensemble to, you know, drive the dance forward with acoustic instruments. You know, and that's how it was really done in those communities for, you know, many decades.
So let's talk about dance. It's a big part of your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a family of dancers. My mm-hmm. my mom, Anne-Marie Gardette, is a specialist of Baroque dance. She participated in the recreation of those dances in France in the 80s, notably with Rize Danserie, Francine Lancelot. So people who did some research in, you know, how to find ways to recreate what was basically the direct ancestor of ballet. Mm-hmm. And my dad, Pierre Chartrand, is a step dancer, Quebecois step dancer, a caller, so someone who does a kind of half speaking, half singing to explain the dance, mm-hmm. you know. That's an American tradition that arrived in Quebec in the 20s or 30s. And they both also are dance researchers, so they've done some historical research and ethnological research on Baroque dance, on the dance that was danced in Nouvelle France, so in the early French colony on the what is now the Quebec and Maritime Territories. And my dad also has done a lot of ethnological studies on the social and solo dancing in mostly in Quebec, but also in the Maritimes and a little bit in Ontario.
So would that be a tradition that was carried down just by showing people? Because with Baroque, I know things were actually written down, right? There's like written descriptions.
Baroque dance has, in France, there's the notation Beauchamp-Feuillet. Mm-hmm. So there are scores for those dances. My mom learned to decipher those things, and she can recreate choreographies that were notated that way. So that's a big part of the work of, you know, Baroque, contemporary Baroque dancers. For the traditional dance, it's based more on collecting. You know, mm-hmm. There are some written sources, because people have been taking note of what was danced during dance evenings or during social events for a very long time. But the practice, the actual movements of the step dancing, the actual movements of the social dancing, the quadrille, the square dances, cotillon, the contredanse, we had living sources of these things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people like Simone Voyer or Normand Legault were pioneers in Quebec of going and meeting those people who still knew those dances and filming, learning those dances and transmitting that knowledge and that practice to the new generation.
This track you're about to hear is called La Petite Marche from the album Le Tranino with Colin Savoie-Levac on guitar, and Alexis is playing modern violin. Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode.
So often when you play, you use your feet as percussion.
Mm-hmm.
I think in English, do we call that clogging?
Clogging is more of a word that we use in England. Mm-hmm. And it references English step dancing.
Okay.
So so the what we call like foot tapping or foot percussion is quite specific to Francophone traditional music in mostly in Eastern Canada, so Quebec, a little bit of Ontario, and in the Maritimes. In Prince Edward Island, they even call it la gigassise. So they have some little choreographies that they can do while sitting down. Its origins are unclear. There's not a lot of very specific research. The earliest written sources of it, I think, are from the early 20th century. But it really, it's something that really most fiddlers from, you know, just before the first half of the 20th century, I think, were doing in Quebec. So the Quebecois fiddlers, like, you know, the ones we all know now, it's like Carignan foot tapped, and Louis Boudreau foot tapped, and André Alain. So all of these people were self accompanying with their feet, and it became it's become a staple of like an identifying staple of Quebecois traditional music, and it's become deeply associated with the image of Quebecois traditional music, both locally and internationally. And it's something that, you know, almost every fiddler I know at least has learned how to do, and whether they do it on stage or often depends on their preferences.
So you have an incredible groove in your playing and flexibility. When you were learning to do the foot percussion with playing, was it hard to coordinate when you were a kid?
I think, if we're talking about groove, in my mind, it has more to do with dance than it has to do with foot tapping. The interesting thing about a practice of music that it has very deep connections with another practice like dance, you know, could be something else, but in that case, it's dance, is that it really reframes the way we think of what our priorities are, you know. And for me, growing up, so I was studying, you know, classical music here in Montreal, but I was also accompanying, you know, my dad's step dancing classes and sometimes social, you know, dancing. And something I quickly realized was that the utmost priority of my playing needed to be like, will it drive and inspire the dancers? Is that, are they going to have fun? You know, are they going to want to dance? Are they going to enjoy that? You know, and without even going into the technical necessities of that goal, you get a pretty strong and immediate feeling of whether you're doing good or not. You know? And then, especially contrasting that with a more academic learning experience in classical music, it's a very, very interesting and, to my mind, healthy way of reframing what we need to think and to think about and prioritize when we're playing. And so, and then once we've, you know, understood that that was the goal, I mean, then we can start learning. You know, I learned a lot from step dancers, listening to the sound of their feet, to the inherent groove that they've developed. To me, that's really the basis of my practice of the bow. You know, all of the rhythms that we have to summon with the traditional style of bowing. Personally, is deeply, deeply related to the practice of step dancing in Quebec.
This next track is Gigue Québécoise en sol with Nicolas Babineau, and Alexis is playing Baroque violin on this track. Thank you.
So in the description of this conversation, there'll be links to your albums and lots of things so people can hear the footwork. But I don't think, are you set up now with a board? Could you?
No, not right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, I didn't figure.
No.
But you do have another instrument by your side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took out a Baroque violin that is being lent to me by a very nice friend and colleague, Alex Keeler. From the Eastern townships, and that's been part of my practice for a few years now. I've been exploring the idea of adapting traditional Quebecois music for a historical instrument.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that hasn't been done a lot in Quebec. I know of some musicians in Quebec City, that Baroque mm-hmm. musicians who've played a little bit of Quebecois music. There's some Baroque violinists in Montreal that have done a little bit of that. And obviously, if we look outside of Quebec, people like David Greenberg have mm-hmm. done an amazing, and really amazingly inspiring work on the connections and, mm-hmm. and you know between Baroque violin and fiddling, but. Not a lot of it has been done specifically with the Quebecois repertoire,
mm-hmm.
and so I've been very interested in trying to make that happen, while keeping in mind that it is, you know, intrinsically anachronistic, because the sources we have for Quebecois fiddling are way too recent for them to have been linked with historical instruments, you know. And the style of playing of Quebecois fiddlers, they're deeply indebted to, you know, the modern violin, the modern construction of the violin, but especially the modern construction of the bow. And obviously, I mean, people who are familiar with, you know, the way bows are made will recognize some of the characteristics of a modern bow with its quite long length, you know. Mm-hmm. It's pretty intricate frog here. It has some garnishes, and it has a screw that allows for, you know, making the hair more or less tense, which are all things that I do not have on the Baroque bow I use. You know, it's a very primitive style of bow. It's much shorter. You know, it fits on the whole screen right now. It has no, it has pretty much nothing on the frog. It doesn't have a screw. It's a little piece of wood that just clips in mm-hmm. place, and I use a little piece of, I think this is leather, to decide how much tension I use, and it's bent differently, so it mm-hmm. reacts deeply differently, and that's been, I think, a big part of my work on the instrument has been trying to find ways to adapt techniques that, you know, have been developed on the modern bow, and try to adapt them to an instrument that is anachronistic. And then the other part of it has been just, you know, taking advantage of the gut strings, mm-hmm. so which have a very, very nice, rich, dark tone that I personally find very, very appealing. But that is maybe less evidently usable in the context of Quebecois traditional music, which is often, you know, very driven, very powerful, and very intense.
You've done some interesting collaborations where you've played Baroque violin with modern at the same time mm-hmm. for that timbre. So, but then you're tuning to our standard modern tuning.
So it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I'm currently working on this on these ideas with my colleague and friend Nicolas Babineau. Mm-hmm. We've already we've been working together for almost 5 years now, and we released already two albums, one in 2017, one in 2019, both of which I only played modern violin on. But last year, you know, throughout my research and my work on the Baroque instrument, and I was talking about it with Nico, and we kind of realized that we were both very excited to try to bring that the possibilities of that instrument into the music of our duo. And so we started doing that, and we're currently working on a project to create a concert that will be presented in a few festivals this summer at Mémoire et Racine in Joliette in late August, late July, and in late August in Beaumont for Esprit de Souche, organized by Marie Musique. We'll also be at Concert des Îles du Bic for a conference and discussion around that that subject of playing traditional music on the Baroque instrument. And indeed, we are doing a lot of work in trying to bring together Nicolas' modern violin and my playing of the Baroque instrument. And it's kind of brought up a lot of very interesting questions of how to bring together those, you know, those two worlds that seem sometimes a little bit incompatible. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is, I mean, you were mentioning tuning, And so I tune the Baroque violin a whole step down, you know. So, you know, historically it would have been an early French tuning, so at A392 instead of A440.
Ah, okay.
You know, for me it's very useful because it's exactly a whole tone lower than the modern instruments. So when I've worked with Lévy Bourbonnais on harmonica, I was playing, we could play together, and it would work perfectly. So we do some of that with Nico, but Nico is also using a lot of cross-tuning on his violin. And so what ends up happening is that his modern violin is not tuned at all in a standard way, you know, and the Baroque violin is tuned usually in a standard way. There's a little bit of cross-tuning, but less so. I find it less comfortable to retune the gut strings. They're a little more sensitive than the modern violin strings. But yeah, a big part of the show right now. So my Baroque violin is tuned. So from top to bottom, it would be D, G, C, F, you know. And Nicolas' fiddle from top to bottom would be F, A, D, F. So a kind of open D minor. And he's been figuring out how to use that, that tuning. And he switches a little bit. Sometimes he plays an E, A, D, E too. And sometimes I tune up the low string, the low F string up to a G to get a traditional tuning that would be called grondeuse in Quebec.
Yeah, I played Baroque violin for quite a few years. It's mostly chamber music. And Bieber wrote quite a few scordatura with really cool tunings. That'd be fun to try.
Yeah, I mean, cross-tuning is a very important part of most fiddle traditions, you know, across North America. Old-time fiddlers cross-tuned a lot. Acadian fiddlers, Quebecois fiddlers, Métis fiddlers from the prairies. It's really a great way to explore, you know, a slightly different feeling on the instrument and explore different possibilities. It creates often like interesting resonances. It allows for different harmonic ideas. In Quebec, there's a lot of very active fiddlers who love cross-tuning to accompany songs. So people like Lisa Ornstein or Pascal Gem, they love to try, you know, very very experimental tunings that allow them to play, you know, chords that will accompany beautifully traditional singing. So it's a very, very interesting tool and a very useful one.
So can we hear a bit of your Baroque violin? Can you play a tune?
Sure. Let's see. I think I'll play a little reel called the Reel des Grands Pieds. It's a tune that I've played for many years on the modern violin, and can be heard at the very beginning of the first album with Nicolas. But I find it interesting to hear the very huge difference in timbre that we get with the gut strings, and that the possibilities that this bow gives us with it. So here, the Reel des Grands Pieds. Thank you.
Oh, so beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you.
So there's so much ornamentation in both hands, it strikes me. And of course, in Baroque times, people were really gifted at improvisation and just all kinds of ornaments. So there's that parallel.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, ornamentation is a very, very important part of both Baroque violin playing and contemporary fiddling. Yeah.
So are there names for all the different, you know, like all the different bow things when you teach it?
So the thing with naming and kind of categorizing and classifying playing is that it is not a worry of everyone. Mm-hmm. It is often, you know, a requirement in academic types of music, you know, people who want to create a syllabus maybe, or a program, or a handbook of ornamentation, or you know, fiddle playing or something. They have an incentive to name and describe and categorize things. Some fiddlers love to do that. Some don't really care for it. Indeed, in my teaching, I often have to, you know, decide on a name for things, so that maybe I can reference it to my students. I'd say that, I mean, in traditional music, there is no overarching authority. And so everyone kind of comes up with their own, you know, names for things, or maybe just with whatever name they heard someone else mention. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of variety in what words people are going to use. But if we listen to the actual techniques, and if we pay attention to what people are actually playing, then we see a lot of commonalities. And, you know, there are ornaments specific, you know, to Ireland, to Scotland, to old-time music, to Acadian music, to Quebecois music, to Ontarian music, mm-hmm. to Métis music. Personally, I've mostly been studying and learning Quebecois ornamentation and Irish ornamentation. Mm-hmm. That's where my personal preferences went to. But Scottish ornamentation is very, very rich. Cape Breton ornamentation is mm-hmm. very, very interesting. There's really like a wealth of knowledge and ideas that we can find just by listening to what other people do. And, stealing an ornament after another, and sometimes coming up with our own personal ways of using those ornaments. But if there's one thing that I find very important to remember regarding ornamentation, is that, especially in certain forms of academic music, we tend to see ornamentation as the seasoning that gets, you know, sprinkled on top of a melody. And what we realize when we dive deep into traditional music, and I think it's probably true of Baroque music, but I'm not an expert in there. But what we realize is that ornamentation is structuring. It structures the phrasing, it structures the bowing. You cannot actually take it away. You know, you cannot take it out of the music. If you do, you get something that to most ears will sound compromised in a way or another. But what's interesting is that you need ornamentation, but you don't need any specific ornamentation. You know, some fiddlers will never learn some of the ornaments that every other fiddlers know how to do. Mm. And some fiddlers will have, you know, a few very specific ornaments they do very well and stick to those ones. And some fiddlers will be going around learning every ornament they can they can find. And so it's not really necessarily about learning the right ornaments as much as it being an integral part of the phrasing and of the practice of that music.
Mm-hmm.
And so I often, you know, warn my students about, you know, leaving it for the end, you know, leaving it for later. I think it's important to take it into account as soon as we start getting interested in a tune or in a whole style of traditional playing.
Mm-hmm.
This next track is Deux Airs de Violon with Nicolas Babineau, and on this track, Alexis is playing baroque violin.
Thank you. And when you tour, I imagine you must collect tunes a little bit. Different.
Oh, that's a good question. I've never felt like I was someone who learned a lot of tunes. I tend to fall in love with tunes and carry them for years and years, mm-hmm. And really, squeeze as much music as I can out of them. Which is why, you know, currently with Nicola, we are working only on repertoire that we've already recorded, but we've changed the mm-hmm. instrumentation, we've changed the arrangements. We find tunes in all sorts of places, but there's no bad place. So sometimes it's, tunes we've heard on a CD, mm-hmm. Tunes we've heard online, tunes we've heard on a documentary, tunes we've heard in person, someone recording it for us, or tunes we've sought out. Mm-hmm. We've heard someone play something and we've been like, where can I find that? Can you record it for me? I tend to believe that most important thing is not necessarily where a tune is found. It's really what we do with it afterwards. Mm-hmm. And what I like about traditional music is specifically that, an oral tradition depends largely on people, passing down melodies, and very often without any recorded or written medium, which means that the tune needs to have stayed alive in their head for at least long enough for someone else to be able to learn it. And so for me, there's something very interesting in the idea that, when we get access to that repertoire, we know that it's been interesting enough to someone, and probably to a few people, to be carried through, a few fiddlers and a few generations. When then we fall in love with that tune, for whatever reason and wherever we found it, that's enough for me to want to play it and to want to perform it and share it with other people.
I have a question about your training as a classical violinist, because you did quite a bit of that, I'm sure, when you're a teen. You went to an arts high school.
Yeah, so I started learning violin in private lessons with a violinist in Montreal named Diane Plante, mm-hmm. Who also played baroque violin, even though I never studied that with her. But it mm-hmm. was always, around. I knew about those things from a very early age. I started around the age of 7, I think. Mm-hmm. So I did, 5-6 years of that. And then I went to Joseph-François Perrault. So it's a high school, a music high school in the Quartier Saint-Michel in Montreal. Public school that, built its music program from the ground up from, I think, the 70s or 80s. And it's now, I think, one of the biggest music programs in high school in Canada. And there, I played, in string ensembles. I played in symphony orchestras. And I sang in the choir, but mostly I really, really discovered, I just discovered and fell in love with a lot of classical and romantic music. Mm-hmm. And that was really, for me, we listened to a little bit of classical music, some Bach partitas and, at home, but I didn't know about, all the a lot of the late classical and romantic music, and mm-hmm. discovering Beethoven, discovering Mahler, discovering a lot of Honegger, like a lot of amazing composers, became like a really, really, really important part of the music I wanted to listen to and to engage with. And after that, I went to Saint-Laurent-de-Cégep in Montreal, and I ended up, was quite lucky to end up in a composition program there, mm-hmm. And I discovered contemporary music and electroacoustic music under the tutelage of an amazing, amazing man called Michel Tétrault, who's been teaching composition almost single-handedly in that program for a few decades now. And, you know, in Cégep, I didn't play violin anymore. So basically, you know, I did 10 years of classical violin. I did traditional music throughout, but on my own and with the people I knew because of my upbringing. But I'd say that, you know, discovering the music was more important to me, actually, in hindsight, than necessarily performing it, I think. Because I think the choral repertoire that I sang, even though I didn't sing it very well, had a tremendous impact on my music making. And so, that was a very, very important part of learning music for me.
Mm-hmm. So I thank you so much for coming today. And I'm just wondering if you could leave us with a ballad.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. That's something I've been working on for, I think, probably 10 years now. You know, the traditional music in Quebec is often associated with high energy dance music. And I was, you know, at the end of my teenage years, I was longing for some slower paced music. And part of it was just taking maybe dance tunes and slowing them down a little bit and changing their mood. But something I also started doing was playing song melodies on the violin, which is something that is very, very common in Ireland, for example. But it's not done a lot in Quebec. It does exist. I didn't invent that. But it's not part of the common practice of fiddlers right now. And that's something I've been always, I've been very interested in for the past 10 years. And it happened to really, really coincide well with my interest in the Baroque violin, because the kind of phrasing we can do with the Baroque bow, the kind of tone we can get from the gut string, lent itself so nicely and naturally to some of these slow songs that I've been carrying for a few years now. So I could play a little complaint. So a traditional melody that I've stripped of its words, but I feel like there are there's an interesting depth and you know, subtlety in how much singers could put in those melodies that could seem oversimplistic to certain people at first glance. And I think that maybe some of the narration, the narrative component of these song melodies gets distilled in the notes that are left when you take the words away. Mm-hmm. So you can try that.
Wow. Thank you so much, Alexei.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. There's such a fascinating variety to life in music, and this series features wonderful musicians worldwide with in-depth conversations and great music, with over 100 episodes to explore. Many episodes feature guests playing music spontaneously as part of the episode or sharing performances and albums. I hope that the inspiration and connection found in a meaningful creative life, the challenges faced, and the stories from such a diversity of artists will draw you into this weekly series with many topics that will resonate with all listeners. Please share your favorite episodes with your friends and do consider supporting this independent podcast. The link is in the description. Have a great week.